so much for doing this. I honestly, the more I read about you, the more I'm fascinated, the more I want to learn more. And I get front row seats for a conversation like this. I'm happy. I don't need anything else. But it's so interesting to me because this is something I've been discovering myself and I'm baffled. You see, Anvesh is 17. I'm not much older. I'm 24 myself. This is the first time I'm entering this domain. And this domain appears from the outside to be so vicious and wild that people who are a certain way in person are so much different on Twitter as soon as politics gets involved. This posturing is so weird.
Yeah, no, it's I'm very conscious of it. Like, I don't think of it as a real means of communication, and I'm probably guilty of it too, you know. But I like to make that clarification that there are these different levels of communication, Twitter being the lowest. Even an op-ed is a posture. You have 1,000 words, you have to say something. It's fairly like, it's not reasoned or deep. It's a provocation to thought at most. And then obviously one hopes with, if you have the fortune of writing books, that that's where the actual more meaningful things can be said. Mm.
So the way I think of postures, or at least I was up until you said what you did, was that it's sort of a mask that people put on. It's sort of, when I think of political posturing, it's sort of almost like I'm referring to a different crowd altogether for a different purpose altogether. So I can be free to have a different personality. Do you mean it differently or do you mean it just the same?
I mean it in exactly the same way. And one has to be, I suppose, very careful not to let the mask eat into the face. You know, you shouldn't become that identity, because exactly what you said, there's a man called Chotaiwala, for instance, who, you know, he can be quite vicious on Twitter. And my friend Ashok Malik at the MEA said he couldn't be a nicer man in real life, you know, and I'm sure that's true. So there we are, you know, it's that's why I think it becomes very difficult when that frenzy or that energy of posturing starts to bleed into like more serious decisions, where people start to make editorial decisions, or people start to lose jobs, or people start to be canceled. Then you're suddenly like, it's sort of like a game or a joke that's been taken too far.
Right. And I mean, I think one of the more interesting parts about you is that it is not just that you write journalistically, you also write fiction books, you write novels, not just fiction books, but novels in general. You explore the psyche of characters. You explore the psyche of yourself in so many places. And I think it'd be an interesting question to ask if this mask eating into the face phenomena, apart from it having consequences to the external world, what do you think? Does it not, like, for me, I grew up, and I don't know why. I genuinely do not. If you ever come across my content on either platforms, the number one value I hold so close to myself is this sense of disgust I get from public performances. It's like, I'm not going to be able to do that, right? And I wonder if one day I let my guard down and that pressure that appears from, you know, having some sort of a public life starts to eat into me. Is that going to affect me personally? Do you think these people who put on masks to the point where their faces are eaten, does it have a consequence on their everyday life?
I think it can have a tremendous consequence. It all comes down to the kind of people are able to make these separations. Actors do it all the time. I think public personalities, public intellectuals can make these divisions. They can also divide different sides of themselves and save the realm of the imagination or thoughtfulness for like an area where it can come out, such as books, or, you know, people can make these divisions, but it's a constant, and it requires a constant vigilance. Because it is very corrosive, it's very addictive, and it sometimes feels like it's everything, but it's not everything, you know. And it's not even a close approximation to truth. And so I think it's something that can be done, but again, like, it depends on, I suppose, somebody's level of self-awareness.
Right. And it's not just Twitter, though. For me personally, I gave up on TV news a very long time ago. I was like, this just does not seem like real people, at least on the Indian TV circus, which is absolutely baffling that it passes as journalism to me. And you realize within those 6-minute shouting contests that the true victim in this situation is me, who's here to gather information. There is almost no sane way to understand this private part of all these public personas who are decision makers and thought leaders of some nature. and you end up feeling, you end up attributing grander causality, like just more noble, this is why so-and-so must have done that. While it turns out that the reason is something far more different from the posturing that I am used to, that the data points that I am absorbing from looking at them outside. And part of the reason why this, why I started down this, how I don't know how to say, but like this political chain of guests to speak about all these political issues is because I was so bad. There's no way to make sense of this from the outside, right? I wonder, yeah, you being in America now that you are in New York, how hooked are you to the Indian political scene? Are you still very hooked?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to. I'm in a situation where the things that that actually feed me about India, which is actually just being in India and being and traveling, especially like those things are sort of closed off to me. And so I keep you know, I've always balanced two or three societies in my head at the same time, and I make it a point to sort of stay in touch. And to sort of keep an eye on what's going on. But I avoid the more corrosive side of it because I think that that's in a sense like part of the freedom of the thing that's happened to me or the situation that I'm in. I don't have to get my hands dirty in the same way. I don't really have to like take on the more corrosive side of what's going on. And we are living through like an steroidal age of sensationalism, you know. I mean, it's really, it was bad 5 years ago, it's worse now, it feels like it could be worse still. So, you know, I mean, it's short of like literally murdering somebody on television, where like we're very, very close to about rock bottom. So so yeah, I mean, you want to be insulated.
You really do. I mean, I did not give two shits about the Sushant Singh controversy until I arrived in India. And then my grandfather's television, all it blares is Riya Chakrabarti at this point. And so that it's like the next step is that she's going to appear in my dreams because there's just so much Riya Chakrabarti on the Indian television scene. So in that limited
sense, something like that is so insidious because it's become a kind of vehicle for a much deeper culture war. And so it's, you know, one thing is playing out on the surface, but we know that it has undercurrents of a much deeper kind of change that people are trying to affect. And you have to question that even if they were right, even if they were saying that Bollywood was a club and that it was dominated by English speaking, even if all of that was correct, like, is this the way to change it? I mean, are you literally going to try to sort of whip up this frenzy of emotion and try to go after these guys? And it's, I mean, it doesn't feel like anything that was resolved in this way could bring out a good outcome.
Right. It does look like a power struggle. It does. And, but my complaint is not as much with the power struggle. In fact, even with politics, I'm not as upset or disappointed at the politicians as I am at the media men, because my eyes and ears are the media men, right? And when I see a respected news channel broadcast images of Riya working out while they comment on her character to some extent, I'm like, oh, come on, like, let's not play that game, you know? Yeah. And this witch hunt, because it's taken a shape of a witch hunt, right? If you, I don't know how hooked you are to the, I hope you're not. I genuinely hope you're not. But when you see delivery boys and security guards being hounded for statements on things,
it is absolutely
absurd. Oh my God, yeah. It is absurd. But yeah. let me start you off on the deep end when it comes to witch hunt. All right. I want to ask you, because your tweet sort of triggered the entire William Dalrymple witch hunt on Twitter as right. well. How does it feel? How does it feel to be the beginning?
I mean, I feel like we have an ill-starred relationship. But like every time I reach out to Willie, something bad happens. In this particular instance, I really, like, I thought, I was worried that he wouldn't take any kind of stand. And I felt it was important to say something. Like, let me say it once, like, it was not my intention that Blooms react one way or the other way or whatever. And I fully legitimately think that it is right to criticize the point of at which they'd come to and could they still have done what they did. So all of that is up for debate. But I wanted to, like, we also have the right to protest. Bloomsbury is an imprint. It's a mark of quality, of standards, you know, and it represents a whole lot of people who've worked very hard to make that name mean something. And if suddenly that name is being debased or it's being used in a way that it would never be used here or in America or in England, or, you know, to publish a kind of writing that isn't, that is firstly dubious in its political connections, dubious in its conclusions, dubious in its quality. I mean, we all have the right to object too. Some people who object are just bystanders. Some people are influential writers. But that, so that, I was sort of like, I was congratulating him for speaking out. And of course, like it, you know, but that was the sort of right wing gang playing mischief. I think they were trying to use that to sort of to go after him. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I felt terrible about it.
Right. I mean, I don't know about feeling terrible, because it's sort of become the kind of a situation where even if, and I can speak from the very limited experience I have, no matter what I say on my philosophy YouTube channel, say I'm referring to Freud, right? Freud has nothing to do with this entire debate. Yeah. People are going to come after me still.
Yeah. To tell me how shipping the white man.
Right. Why don't you talk about what is in the Gita? And I have all due respect for that. But think about what you're saying. It's not the same territory. We are speaking on different planes here, right? But it's gotten to the point where my channel grew massively over the last couple of months. And I think the reason why it did is because people are intellectually hungry. And to the greatest extent that intellectual hunger is being satisfied is with a bunch of people that are pro-Hindutva. And for that reason, you know, the satiation happens through that. And therefore, there is some sort of a wildfire happening on that end. And at a certain point, I was like, you know what? I cannot continue having that conversation. I will saturate myself. I need to know where I'm wrong. And that's how I started, you know, I got in contact with you and all that. So with this book, because again, as an outsider, as somebody who's not, you know, wired into the system, I hear stuff about that the book is, you know, they made it into a freedom of speech expression. The fact that, you know, the book's allowed to be published, you know, this is one of the narratives, the many narratives that exist, and journalists have resigned to it. You know, intellectuals have resigned to the fact that every aspect has many narratives. And so we can pick whatever narrative we want to support. Are we sure that book was really that inaccurate when it comes to, you know?
I mean, I don't, like, it's for me less a question of inaccuracy. It's and the book is being published. So this is not Sleeman Nasreen. This is not Salman Rushdie. This is not Wendy Doniger. Like, this is not a state. You know, when you speak of freedom of speech, you speak primarily of two things. One, that the state not silence you. And the other, that violent protest, which is protest that could do you bodily harm. If we like take that Clausewitz idea of the state possessing a monopoly on the use of violence, that kind of violence not cow you into silence. Those are primarily the things we're talking about. We're not saying that somebody publish a provocative book, invite somebody to the launch who's raised the most vile slogans, who's been part of the precipitation of violence, that all of that occur. And we, protecting freedom of speech, restrict our own speech. That would be an absurd proposition, you know? So that question that we don't have the right to speak out against someone who's spoken out, that's obviously complete, I mean, that wouldn't work at all. But the question, I think that if you are casting a light or casting a questioning glance on Bloomsbury and the way that the editorial has been handled and the way that they behaved, probably you're right to do it. Probably we on one side who object to the kind of direction Bloomsbury India has taken, we also have a right to question that. But I think that absolutely, I have a lot of sympathy for the authors. I think that that's a very, like, that's an awful thing to have happen. I wouldn't want to have that happen to me. So obviously something went wrong at Bloomsbury. And I think people are right to question that. Mm.
It is also very suspicious that, you know, the way the entire series of events went down was very atypical. You know, first it's getting published. All these people are being invited. Suddenly there's a furor. And then suddenly Bloomsbury, like, you know what, we can't do this anymore. And then the book gets so much publicity, it's a bestseller even before it comes out of the market. And bystanders like me, common people like me are like, all right, all of this happened while we just took a nap. Like, this was like a 6-hour duration before all of this went down. And it's, to me, it's interesting. To me, it's so interesting. And I think you pick on this theme in if not one, more than one of your books. This idea of a historical romanticism. You see, I am some sort of a pragmatist, and my job on the internet, apart from this podcast, which is where I'm chasing my curiosity, is to offer people some sort of philosophical guidance. And when I do that, I tell them, hey, listen, the explanation to you is not in your past. It's in your future, no matter who you are, no matter what is happening.
Yeah.
Right. But as a country, as a society, there is this very weird fascination with our history that I did not see in America at all.
So that's it's a very interesting, you know, Octavio Paz has that very lovely book called In Light of India. And he says, in reference to Mexico, he says, you know, one of the great differences that separates a country like India and Mexico from the United States is that America, in a sense, is the people have individual histories, but the country itself has no history. The country looks to the future. It looks to modernity. It is modernity. Whereas in countries like India and Mexico, the future kind of depends on the way the questions of the past are resolved. And I would separate myself from what you said earlier, which is that I don't support historical romanticism, which is to say a sentimental view of the past, which is even further to say a wish to recreate or bring back the past. For me, my love of history is predicated on understanding that the past is dead, on that Napoleon idea that one draws a line. Having drawn that line, having recognized that history is behind you and that the future lies ahead, I feel very strongly that cultures can be nourished by the past, that creative relationship with the past, of which perhaps the Renaissance is like the finest example, it can lead to like tremendous sense of cultural confidence, of strength, of ingenuity, of renewal, of people feeling that they too have something. And in India, of course, we have a tremendous, very rich intellectual inheritance, which I completely feel that like, if people are suddenly quite jingoistic about those things, it is because there is a kind of realization that part of the legacy of the colonial experience was that we were cut away from those things. You know, we didn't receive them with the delight and with the enthusiasm that one could have, and that they would have been something that would have been intellectually very invigorating. So it's the two things together. It's realizing that the past is over, that it's dead, and that it must be seen as dead. And at the same time, absolutely loving the idea of history, absolutely loving the idea of being nourished by a sense of wonder about it's because it's an aspect of curiosity, you know?
Right. And so tell me if I made sense of that accurately. So it seems like what you're trying to say is that there is a sort of a nourishment that gets passed on because by effect of having such a cultural depth. But because we had such a long period of disconnect, that there is a sort of a jingoistic overcompensation. Am I understanding you correctly?
It is, but one of the sort of symptoms of that compensation is that piety, not the intellect, not intelligence, not inquiry, not the life of the mind. Piety is being made to stand in for intellectual inquiry. So it's not saying, oh, we knew this, we knew that, we were so great, and look at the Gita, and look at, like, leave all that aside. Begin with the proposition that your history is junk. You have nothing. Just pretend for argument's sake that that's the case. And then go after it in a spirit of intellectual inquiry, because there's all the difference between being inspired by the past and being mired in the past. So you were mentioning the example of the United States here. You're right, there is history here that is miring. The racial history is extremely miring, but there is also on the side of that an engagement with the past that's creative and intellectual. There's an industry of books, of television shows, of like endless stimulus that is to do with looking at the past and rethinking the past and feeling it as part of one's intellectual inheritance. And what I fear is happening at the moment in India is too much a worship of one's past, you know, and worship doesn't get you anywhere. It doesn't lead to creativity. It's how many times can you say Bharat Mata Ki Jai? You know, what will that produce? So it's that other side of like critical inquiry and of thought and of actually like comparing one's past to other places of like of actually like looking at one's history in ways that are intellectually exciting that I support and I don't support piety.
Were you not personally infatuated with history as well? Is that not what you studied?
I never studied history, but I love history. I love that relationship between past and present. I love it both in individuals. I love to see the way people reckon with their own private histories, but I also love the way nations reckon with history. I love that tension between the present and the past. I think it's like very interesting, and it can lead you down the path of destruction, but it can also like bring you, it can also be like
a mirror,
a kind of wellspring. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So it is interesting to me in more than one ways, the fact that, I mean, you spent a considerable amount of time in Banaras, right?
Yes.
And it is one thing to speak of Banaras as a group of people, as a concept for a city, as an extension of a historical path, of a cultural, you know, artifact and all that. And then it is different to speak of it in terms of individuals, right? People who live there, the psyche that acquires them, the mindset that they live with, the kind of conditions that they live with, what they think of their past, present and future. And I'm curious, this is a question I ask people of different trades in any case, in a different format, but here is how I'll ask this question to you. What is it that you learned from living in Banaras that is absolutely unobvious to somebody who's never done that? That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a nice one. It's a nice one.
Thank you. I take that.
I mean, I have to say, like, the thing for me was that, it was almost a sensual feeling. Like, I arrived with this sense of New York time. I felt like I wanted to go efficiently about my interviews. I wanted to like collect my information and write my book and like, you know, go about it all very methodically. And people kept smiling at me over there. And they would be like, you know, like if you don't have the blessings of Karl Bhairav, if you don't understand this subtle side of the city, like you're dealing with material surfaces, but there is another Banaras of tradition, of faith, of like almost a mental image, like a kind of focusing point for the spirit, for this other, like if you don't engage with that world, which includes a world of magic, it includes a world where everybody lives by the stars, it includes a world where someone would take their child to a witch doctor before they would go to like a conventional proper doctor. Yeah, if you don't somehow understand that tradition is alive there and that tradition has its own logic and its ways of thinking and of believing, you won't, there's a part of this city that you'll completely miss. Like you would have gone away with a very thin impression. And it was very hard for me that, because it meant letting go of this rational self that I associate with the West and with, I also associate it as a way of like self-preservation, you know, it's like, I don't want to have this other way of thinking. Like I have no place for this in my life. But Banaras really brought me very close in moments to something that was really part of the ancient world and that was like frightening and fascinating at the same time. And I think that till you live there and you start to reckon with it, that you can't really understand that deeper side of it. And people say it all the time, you know, that one of the really intelligent sort of sages of Banaras says, I mean, anybody can see the physical city of Banaras. He said, but the real Banaras or the subtle side of Banaras, it's like the sun behind the clouds. And if there isn't this effort of internal visualization of this other, you don't access it. So it was a very self-conscious sense of what this city meant, and I had to find a way to enter into that.
And did you?
Partially. I don't think I could have entered into it fully without a loss of self, or a loss of one kind of self. But sometimes you can get an intimation of something, and at the same time not necessarily cross the line, you know.
So interesting.
I can't cross the line now. It's too late for me. You know, I'm somebody who's grown up in an extremely, like, an extension of scientific culture in the West. I'm part of that
way of thinking.
Civilization. Yeah, that way of thinking.
Right. Right.
And so that again brings us back to that question that one can't walk back the past. You know, there's a lot of people hungering for, like, ancient India. But, you know, the ancient world was full of things that you don't want and that you can't really recreate again. So you have to find a way to be simultaneously modern and at the same time, like, engaged with the past, you know. So anyway, but coming back to what you were saying,
you're right. I think that is a society-wide conflict that inhabits every individual's mind, this need to make sense of modernity, science on one end, and this deep sense of tradition, because I see that often being fractured with very urban families, like my own family, right? I remember I had, jaundice. And we were taking modern medication.
I had jaundice too, yeah.
Right? And modern medication was taking its time. But my dad's like, you know what? Take him to that guy that does that weird thing with, like, eggs and dahi. And so my mom did. And when I healed, the primary attribution was the traditional instead of the scientific. Or even the biological. My body might have just healed itself. And it is a very interesting coexistence. It is indeed a very interesting coexistence. And it is so interesting you say that there is a sort of a hesitation you'd have lost the self right in the city where the Ganges is supposed to, you know, wash your sins away in a way, which is similar to the sense of, like, you know, there is something very interesting. A friend of mine said to me the other day, and I think that is something that probably we are circling around when we're talking about this. And he said, there is a very clear distinction between India and Bharat. And I never thought of it that way.
Right. Well, that comes up in the Twice Born a lot.
Right.
Yeah. Distinction. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was the inspiration to go to Banaras and live and, you know, spend that time and understand Banaras? Was that a search for Bharat? Is that what was happening?
Well, so the twice born Dvija in Sanskrit refers obviously to the Brahmins of Banaras, who were my prism. I wanted primarily to speak to them. But the other sense of the twice born was this idea of ancient cultures reborn as modern nations, Bharat reborn as India. And the birth pangs of that second birth, of the ancient country reckoning with this, like, ill-fitting, difficult, but modern iteration of a nation like India. And so I wasn't so much looking for Bharat as I was exploring the tension between India those two concepts. Yeah.
Right. Right. Right.
And the truth is that there's, you know, the last line of that book, he says, Tripathi says, he says, one thing I know is that death is real. And of course, like, in the city of death, what I was reckoning with was the idea that Bharat must die. You know, that Bharat, in a sense, as much as we love it, as much as we're inspired by it, it won't live on. You know, even the people who yearn for it are already belong to India. You know, so there's a moment, in fact, where, like, it was, so I went thinking, here I am, westernized, out of touch with my culture, out of touch with my place. If I find myself among Brahmin communities who've come in very ancient ways to Banaras to learn Sanskrit, to be part of traditional culture, then I'll find people who are rooted, who in a sense are not living with a conflicted reality. And it was a great surprise to me that very young Brahmin kids, as well as older people I spoke to, they had all experienced, without ever leaving sometimes Banaras, they had all experienced this incursion from modernity. They'd all been remade in a sense by this interaction with modernity. And I remember, like, look, finally towards the end, looking for somebody who was actually tradition bound. And Kamleshtha Tripathi had sent me to this guy who was a teacher at the Samved school, and a man called Shastri. And he said he really lives as people used to live 1,000 years ago. And I went to see him, and I remember I couldn't even translate this word, modernity, for him, because he didn't know what that meant. And so finally, we came to Kaliyug as a synonym for modernity. And I said, you know, what is the value of teaching the Veda in the age of Kaliyug? And he says, you know, jab bhad aati hai, like when there's a flood, he said the farmer will take the seed and he'll put it in a pod up in the tree, and when the flood subsides, there can be farming again. And he said, this is what we do, and this is all that can be done. And so there was an actual ancient voice in some ways who I had to translate my concerns for, and he was responding to those concerns. But the great majority were already, in a sense, with all their longing, with all their pain for the death of Bharat, they had already been remade without sometimes even leaving Banaras. They had become part of this empire of modernity. And so we shouldn't ever fool ourselves about the fact that, you know, that's where nostalgia leads you astray and you think, oh, we can be as people were before. It's a lie. It can never happen.
No, you're right. I think you're very right. I think Bharat has to go through a sort of a metaphorical death where, you know, it's sort of like the phoenix burning for, you know, it to reemerge from the ashes, kind of a situation where, you know, and I'm sympathetic with it. It's also interesting that Bharat and India, first of all, I mean, will have political implications. Like we can draw out coordinates that refer to Bharat and India in the political sphere, but then there is a sociological sphere. And I think you hit it bang on with that story where it's a conflict between modernity and an agrarian society, civilization history. Like it's sort of like this. I often wonder if, like, it's such a cocktail where a very agrarian mindset meets just the ills of cheap capitalistic modernity, and that cocktail produces some of the weirdest side effects. And maybe the people that you were meeting, I don't know if you would say they were halfway between Bharat and India, or if they'd occupied some part of India and some part of Bharat.
Right.
But it's sort of like that when you see a Baba holding a phone doing his Facebook, you know, it's kind of like very.
Right? And the people who I met were very, very aware that that technology, that phone, you know, it was a Trojan horse of a sort, like that it was not just a tool, that tool contained ideas and ways of being, and like would lead them into a world of conflict. So, you know, when he was talking of this man in my book about Trishanku ki avastha, you know, being in the state of Trishanku.
What does that mean?
Trishanku was the king who was hung in the limbo between when Vishwamitra and who am I thinking of, the other sage, you know, it'll come to me in a second, but there are two sages who have this great battle, and Vishwamitra is the Kshatriya sage and the other is a Brahmin sage, and they have an intellectual battle, and in the course of this battle the king Trishanku becomes suspended in midair. He's in limbo,
right?
And that was this man's like image for saying that state of being neither here nor there. Like tradition hasn't been renounced, but this modernity has not come in its fullness. It's Vyas, by the way. I think it's Vishwamitra and Vyas.
I was going to guess that.
But anyway, so just coming back to this The other thing that had been very destructive was that, which was not the ambition of modernity earlier, was that it had become synonymous with Western culture. And a lot of people, like in the older generation of, let's say, that post-World War history of the kibbutz, of Tel Aviv, of Nehru, of Le Corbusier, there was this idea that modernity would be culturally neutral. And that after the very specific onslaught of culture that colonization was, that here was a way for us all to partake in something that would free us from cultural specificity, but that would also be, we would be able to partake in the richness of modernity without associating that modernity as simply being Western culture again. And in that respect, we've completely failed. People who experience modernity now experience it with that sense of affront because they associate it with a tremendous sense of loss for themselves and with being indoctrinated in a foreign culture. So that more profound, more neutral spirit of modernity that was not necessarily tied to one culture, to the influence of one culture, that hasn't had the success one would have hoped to,
right?
And so it engenders tremendous feelings of loss.
I never realized it up until I got on YouTube, primarily possibly because my social circles were insulated. But since I did get on YouTube, and I probably never confessed it either, but I've become more lost at home than I've ever been. It's sort of me realizing how much of a, how different. And I don't mean that in a qualitative way, it's better or worse. There's none of that, but how just different I am from my immediate physical surroundings. The surroundings I'd not cared to explore because I was riding behind a car with an AC and all, you know, all that jazz.
Right.
And so it's interesting that in one sense, somebody like me is lost, right? Where modernity has infused my traditional value with my traditional values, created this weird alchemy that I do not know how to make a sense of. But I think Twicebond talks about it's probably that, or if I'm not mistaken, it talks about a different kind of being lost, right? Like there is a sense of being lost that book refers to, and I'm interested in picking that up. How is it that you felt lost? What is Atish's lost look like?
Well, you know, I understood that sense of loss in a very, very narrow way, which was that here I was setting out, let's say in 2000 or 2005, to be a writer in India. And I felt that I lived in a place where writing had occurred for 20 centuries, but I knew nothing, that different barriers of a kind of impermeable rock separated me from the different layers of living history in India. And that what I had felt very thin. It felt like I had to always live guessing at what new invention would come out of Europe and America that I would in some way respond to and come running after, and that I didn't have a creative relationship with my place. You know, I felt a sense of fraudulence. And that was like the primary objective of my mid-20s leading into the 30s, and now I'm almost 40, was this sense of overcoming that limitation of somehow being able to break down some of those barriers and to engage with things that had been closed to me. And I think that the way things were and the Twicebond are the product of that creative engagement. But I was also dealing with the fact that that I didn't want to make a return journey. I didn't want to I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to forsake the person I had become in that contact, both in India with the West and then actually in the West. Like I was going to be that person, but I was also not going to be limited by being that person. So do you understand what I'm what I'm saying? It was
I kind of do. Maybe I feel maybe, and I'm not sure, because I need to understand what, or at least I need to ask you politely what those barriers were, because maybe I feel inklings of a similar lostness, maybe. But what were those barriers? What do you mean? Is it linguistic barriers?
Primarily barriers. Language was a huge, huge feature, of course. I mean, my grandfather was an Urdu poet. Like, there had been a huge modern movement of Hindi and Urdu writing, which I was, my Hindi and Urdu at that time was not good enough to read. Mm. So there was a very clear linguistic barrier. Far ahead of that, or deeper into the past, was this super exciting world of Sanskrit literature, which I love language, and I love the complexity of language. I love grammar. And here was this sister of the great, like, Western languages of Greek and of Latin, and which had 10 centuries of, like, literary production and writing and all of those things, which would have been, like, I was a curious, intelligent kid. I would have loved those things, but they were never made available to me. Like, there was a kind of invisible force steering me in different directions. And so in college, I wanted to learn French. And if you see my notebooks from that time, there's this, like, rather pathetic need to, like, learn the trappings of Western culture, to sound very familiar, to sound very fluent. And then there comes a moment where you think, who are you doing this for? Mm-hmm. Like, is this real growth? Is this real intellectual engagement? Or do you just want to pass? And I have to say, like, for a long time, I felt the failure of that. I felt that I was putting on an act. Mm-hmm. I thought if writing was to get good, if I was to produce something meaningful, I would need for, like, a much more vigorous, like, intellectual connection with this place that I've grown up in, where both sides of my family come from. And I would need to somehow, like, have some kind of personal reckoning with the way, the kind of weird place I'd been left at as someone born in 1980, you know. So it was the first level. But then obviously there were huge other things, like, you know, it's changing now, but the world I grew up in, if you said you were learning Sanskrit, like, my mother's friend would be like, oh, why are you bothering with all that chanting, you know? Or it would be like, it was a culture of contempt. Like, it was Robert Byron, who writes so wonderfully about the way that the sensibilities of the British were blunted in India, and that they were put out of sympathy with India. Well, something very similar was happening with us. Like, we were not designed to look at people past a certain social or educational strata and to see their humanity, to understand that they would be full of all kinds of very rich, like, cultural inheritances, of stimuli, of tradition, of, like that. There was a kind of, and I sometimes think of it as the legacy of caste, but it was a very dehumanizing experience, the way that I grew up in India. I felt that a tiny portion of people were available to me and fully human and complex, and that my reading of this much bigger world around me, very thin, very arid, I was unable to see in the ways that I would have liked to see. And that it took some effort to overcome that.
Right. That is, it is so interesting. You say, you know, the fact that there were only a few people who were complex enough because they were near enough. Everybody else sort of existed behind this veil of abstraction, where they became concepts of some nature. And I don't know, I'm not intellectually aware enough to pinpoint at whether there is a legacy of caste that causes this, but there is definitely an existence of class. There is a very clear divide that, well, I mean, I go to America, I do all my chores myself, I figure it out, you know, all that happens. I come back to India, and then I have to contest with that, the reality that there is somebody from a different class that is supposed to be employed, that is supposed to do all that stuff for you. And, you know, there is cognitive dissonance. And it is not even like, I mean, it doesn't even look like we're socially ready for that kind of a reckoning. We don't look like a civilization that's going to wake up on itself and be like, listen, man, we are also talking about these people, like the same stuff. It's,
yeah.
I think you use the word hardwired.
And isn't it? Yeah. And it's such a wonderful feeling in, you know, I remember like really loving the fact I cook quite well now, that I do all of those things and not being in situations where I was dehumanizing people. There's somebody who works as a super in my building, but that person is then also like having a beer down the road from me. Mm. And like, I don't treat him, I don't think of him as in some ways like indentured to me. Mm. I think of him as somebody who's, you know, a completely autonomous human being doing a job. And that level of like, I hated that about my life in India. I don't know if I could have had a different life, you know. I feel like maybe, you know, but it was very hard for me because I had family in India and they had already a way of engaging with the place. And, you know, it was not,
I don't even think
to some extent you inherit those things, you know?
Right. Here is, even if I were to revolt against that, because I have a problem with masks in general, and I go down to my family and like, listen, we can't do this no more. Right?
You don't mean like COVID masks. You no. mean like...
I am a Trump supporter. You have masks. No idea.
You don't know.
Right. No, I mean, it's... Things don't exist in isolation. Like my revolt cannot exist in isolation if nobody is ready to understand. The economics is not ready to... There is so many factors that go into sort of something like that, right? And
yeah.
we're pretty far behind in terms of understanding that. And I think part of it is the legacy of colonization. The fact that, yeah. you know, there is some sort of a societal trauma where we have existed as that class. And then the ones that who managed to escape it automatically occupy the colonizer mindset. That might be a guess. I may be very wrong about that too. I'm curious to know what you think about this. Yeah. It's almost unerasable form of classism that I don't know what yeah. to make sense of. What do you think?
I mean, it's firstly to your point, it's absolutely right. It's very important not to deal with something so serious in trivial or cosmetic ways. You know, I had a friend once would come, very privileged girl, and she would take auto rickshaws in Delhi, even though it was very clear that like she lived in a palatial apartment and she could well afford like 5 cars with air conditioning. And but it was like, don't let that little thing make you feel good about yourself, because it's actually you shouldn't look away because mm-hmm. you fucking took an auto rickshaw. You know, that's not a like a serious wreck. So I absolutely agree, you can't have this revolt in private. As to your other question, are you asking why it's so intractable? Are you asking why it runs so deep? This
I'm
sense
curious.
Of differentiation?
Yeah, I'm curious. In your, because listen, it's not just that you lived in those parts of the country. It's also that you studied the history. It's also that you studied the linguistic history, right? There is a certain understanding, I'm sure, that you have of the phenomena. And so I'm curious, what does it say? What does our history say about our present situation vis-a-vis this context?
See, I think sometimes, and this is going to sound very politically incorrect, when somebody is dealing with their own system of differentiation, let's say class in England or caste in India, there can be inequality and differentiation. And at the same time, like there's, if not mobility, there's still more humanity in a system like that. Like people, what can happen as these systems progress, and especially as new systems of inequality are heaped onto old systems of inequality, is that that rank becomes calcified. It becomes ossified in certain ways, and people are not able necessarily to reach. You know, somebody living in a caste-bound society knows the basis of why he may think of himself as superior or somebody else as inferior. And he can change those things. Gandhi could change those things. He could, he knew that system, that language. He could effect a movement of change within that language.
Hmm.
When you have something like class, which we have to some extent inherited from the Europeans, which is shot through with aspects of caste kind of sitting like a solid block of concrete over this other structure, it becomes harder for people to identify what it is that they're responding to. Sometimes they respond, you know, Naipaul used to say that the differences were almost like, they were almost like racial differences, you know, between people of privilege or people of education and people of poorer backgrounds and all these things. And it becomes like you're responding to something very deep and animal, but you're not responding in ways where you can actually identify that thing. And you're not like it. And so it creates a stasis that's much harder to shake up. Having said that, I believe it is being shaken up. Mm. You know, however much there are things that I don't like about what's happening right now in India, it is a tremendous time of flux.
Mm.
And one hopes, like, well, flux is, you know, it has good possibilities, and you can also commit suicide, and all of those things are happening side by side. But so I think that the shakeup is occurring, and it sort of remains to be seen the direction it takes.
Because God knows, up until I remember growing up with, we used to have this common, I don't even know, saying that we rationalize things away by saying India ka to yehi, India ka to kya ho sakta hai, India mein to aise hi chalta hai, which was sort of a signifier, because it's automatically interesting to me when there is a common phrase in language that elicits, that is expressed to, you know, for the same effect. Like, there is so many ways of saying that. The reason why everybody was saying that, there is something unique about that. And the fact of the matter is, there was sort of this institutional laze that people felt, that people felt like the institutions weren't responding. And now, most definitely, there is, if not an overaction, there is some sort of an action. You see the change happening. And you're right, it could move in both a positive and a negative direction.
People feel a sense of ownership over their institutions or their government and things.
Right, right. And I get concerned only when I begin to think, because some part of this new Bharat/India that we are yearning to create has civilizational traits, right? This continuation of a civilization. We want to do Indic civilization. Some of it, because this civilization is not homogenous. It's so heterogeneous. It's such an alchemy that to solidify the point of rendezvous as to where we meet, that civilizational aspect sort of transmutes into an ideological aspect. And that worries me. That worries me a lot politically, that I do not want somebody else telling me what my Hinduism is going to look like.
Yeah.
That is something, you know what I mean? I'm also interested in the fact that, you know, you studied, you sat down with Sanskrit long enough, and you get trashed on enough by people for being all sorts of thing when they've really not invested that time at all. Right? Like, what do you think?
So to describe the mechanism, the thing that we're talking about, and there's, again, like, I refer you to this wonderful book by Octavio Paz, and he was such a, like, thoughtful, again, somebody who put in a lot of time, and he was coming not from the position of the colonist or the white man. He was Mexican in fairly recent memory, who really bothered to try to think about India, especially in light of his own country. And he talks about this process where he says, you know, the conversion of culture into religion always ends with the conversion of religion into politics. And I think something like that is playing out right now in India. And it is dangerous in many ways, because with every one of those transitions, a certain kind of richness or complexity, you know, the Hindu culture that we inherited is, as you said, full of subtlety, full of heterodox practices, full of things like it can't be reduced to like slogans and to sort of a certain political ideology. But it's also very difficult. It's a very difficult culture to apprehend, to deal with. It's not, and this other thing is much easier. It's a much easier way to swallow, where you think you're getting your past, but actually you're getting
a reduced version. the skim milk of your past, huh?
An adulterated version of that.
Right.
Yeah, it's been remade in certain ways, and you think like you're actually engaging with, you're not getting it with all its depth. And what was interesting in Banaras was that the really good Brahmin could see this. Hmm. They were like, when the Congress was in power, they're like, it was fine. They did their little English Saab thing, and that was fine for them. And we had our culture and tradition. And they said, but these guys, they want what we have. And when they're done with it, it's not going to be recognizable anymore, you know?
Right.
Because it's really like, I mean, even to read, you know, the end of something like the Kumara Sambhava or whatever, in its sexuality, in its like, it's a deep 20 centuries or 15 centuries later, it feels shocking, you know, which is very like, that's the kind of culture that one is engaging with. And so if you're this really kind of sort of, if you're kind of in this very reductionist, you know, trying to turn it into some tame version of Christianity and Islam with a kind of Ram as your prophet and the Gita as your Quran, and you know, you're like you're gonna have to lose a lot to make such a complex culture fit into such a little frame, you know?
Right.
And that's the fear. Like, not that that should matter, but a lot of my concern doesn't come from like, I don't want poor Muslims to be targeted, and to me, I find that all of that horrible. But like, the animating concern for me is like my fear for Hindu culture and tradition, which I've like spent so many years like engaged with, and which I'm in many ways I consider mine. And I don't want it to become something simple and crude.
Were you seen as an outsider when you were, you know, so invested in Hindu culture? Was that ever a thing growing up?
You don't know. I mean, India was so, so strangely welcoming. Like, my grandparents, they were not traditional, but they were sort of very grounded, religious, Sikh family, fairly conservative. And you would imagine this huge shock of like, your daughter has like an affair with a Pakistani and there's a child out of wedlock, and a lot of people could have made that situation, including in the United States, could have made that very uncomfortable, could have made me feel a sense of exclusion. And it really wasn't like that. It was the opposite. I was showered in a feeling of love and a sense of acceptance, and it basically like, I mean, when people say now, like, oh, you're an Islamist or a Pakistani or whatever, like, I find it just mind-boggling, because it's, and people will say things like, they'll be like, you know, oh, well, you have no right to comment because now you have a foreign passport, which I've always had. And I think like, it's so insane to say that. You're talking to somebody who's been 30 years out of 40 years in that country, like, you wouldn't say it to Raghu Karnad or to Madhav Khosla. You're obviously like identifying like some part of me, which you think like by my birth or my blood that I'm like, and actually some of the more vicious people actually say that. They say it's your blood. So like, my response is, well, I can't fix that. You know, there's nothing I can do.
Right. It is.
But,
right. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. But it's so there is like this, you know, there's an extent to which one can be one's own person, but like, you're also, who you are is also in part decided by what people make of you, you know? And as far as like the situation goes in India now, it's just, it's so unequivocal that it's been decided that I'm something I'm not, I really don't have a say in the matter.
Do you sometimes often check inside and be like, am I really this, what people are calling me? Does that happen? You know, what's interesting to me is within this block of 5 or 6 years, an entirely new vocabulary was created, put into effect, and it got successful as far as the political domain was. Right. And that sort of, in a demand supply model, it sort of speaks to the hunger that the unrepresented, whoever the unrepresented were 6, 7, 10 years ago, had for something like this. Right. And I don't know how fair it is to you or to this conversation to bring it up. I don't know how you feel about it, but
you can bring up anything you like.
Cool. I mean, I was reading the how do you say the infamous article, the divider in chief article. And
oh right,
it did not like. I was like, any person who read it cannot really make the case that this is written by. You know, like it's a critique. It's a fair critique. I can totally imagine somebody sensible, rational, absolutely fine having that point of view.
Yeah.
What do you think happened? Like that was such a clear.
I think it was purely visual. Like right. I think it was like I think they saw this cover, which they associated with prestige. Which, by the way, does not have that prestige here anymore. Like people like The New Yorker, The Economist in India, they're like, yeah, koi faltu magazine. With time, they somehow like attributed a prestige to it, which doesn't have anymore. And they saw this image of this person who, at a very volatile time, who they wanted to see honored. Right. And when it was like this negative image with this negative headline, like it was completely like visceral. And obviously it was egged along by the you know, the Sambit Patras and that kind of group who were like, you know, leading the charge. But the reaction to me was completely, they were not reacting to words. They were reacting to an image.
Right.
And going just berserk over it.
Have you made peace with whatever happened since then? Are you like happy in New York now? Is that how it is?
I've made peace in some. Sometimes I even think that I'm almost grateful to Modi for some reasons, because you know I was very much caught between cultures at that point, and what this did for me was that it made me realize that probably India, given my background, was not a place where I was very welcome, and if it hadn't come to that, I may have like lived with illusions for much longer. And as it was, like, and it's not that it's not painful, it is painful, but it's better to have that clear-sightedness and to kind of make a go of another life at a time when one still can, you know. If that had happened to me when I was, let's say, 60, what would I have done? You know, like what, I couldn't have started again. I couldn't have really gone anywhere, but it's sort of like there was a finality to it. And then it was followed so much by like the fact that I actually physically couldn't even come back to India. And so together it was like, I was like, you know, this thing is happening. It's happening in a way that concerns many more people than just yourself. And you're lucky that something has happened that's kind of woken you up to it before it was too late.
So am I correct in understanding? Tell me if this sounds accurate. It's sort of like the sentiment of being lost that you earlier mentioned was settled by somebody else through a move, which was...
Right. And it's very difficult for me, you know, because I'm not a religious person and I'm certainly not a Muslim. I didn't grow up in a, and that's not to use that word in a negative way. Like I have my sister I have family that like from Muslim backgrounds, but I didn't grow up in a Muslim family, and I can't become a Muslim because somebody else tells me I'm Muslim.
Right, right.
You know, so it's not something that I can do. And actually, like if there's ever been worship in my life, it's almost completely focused, not even around Sikhism, but around Hindu gods. I've been a Shiv Bhakt for basically most of my life. And so like when you find yourself in that situation, you then definitely want to get away. Because here I can have a very deep engagement with Indian culture. And all of these things that I love about India can completely be mine. But I don't have to like live in a place where I'm defending an identity
that's not even yours.
I don't feel, you know, so it's really too murky that to be in that situation. And I don't want to spend my, like, who wants to spend the rest of their life? Like, you know, like at the partition, they used to tell this joke where this family was like, Hindu family were wandering around and there were mobs roaming the street, and they said, you know, tum Musliman ho, tum Musliman ho. And they were like, because they were so much part of Urdu culture. They're like, Khuda ke waaste hum Musliman nahi hain. They were like, basically like walking into the trap. But it's like, it's like one of those situations where you just, you don't want to deny something, but at the same time, you can't be that thing. And the pressure is tremendous, and you don't want to spend your life, you know, trying to yell people down.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like you were forced into a controversy in a sense, right? And you probably don't want any part of it because probably everything that is causing that controversy is not accurate. So there is sort of a separation, then insulation that you got from the whole situation in that sense. But I have a personal question, and feel free to, again, you know, be like, I don't want to answer that, but how does it feel to be, for just no accurate reason, be disliked by so many people? How was that?
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, it's not a crowd that they don't remember, but I used to get the same thing from the Pakistani trolls once upon a time. And those guys were like really dangerous. They could come and kill you, you know? Right. So it was
one added level of danger.
So I said to my sister the other day, I said, you know, like, if you posted this, would you get trolled? She's like, I wouldn't get trolled. I wouldn't run a hate campaign against it. They'd kill me. So like it was, I'd kind of experienced that. And I don't like, so when I experience it, like a symmetrical or a mirror image of it, like, it doesn't mean anything to me. Those are not people who I think of as capable of real thought or complexity. Like, they're very, or at least in their incarnations in social media and stuff, they're very, they're too limited to affect me, you know. It's not it doesn't touch me at all. Water off a duck's back.
It's a lot of herd behavior on social media. Like, I once got oh my god, that was so, one time while I was in New York, I wake up this morning and I'm suddenly viral on Twitter for no good reason. I'm not popular enough or important enough to be viral of any nature, but this is what had happened. All right. So on my Hindi philosophy YouTube, I put up a cover from a Jimi Hendrix album. I'm forgetting the name, where, you know, he's his face and there's 10 faces of Vishnu or some shit like that. There's a Hindu god behind. And I'd edited my face onto Hendrix's face to announce season 2 or some, you know, marketing gig like that. And I'd just been like, okay, you know what? Some people are going to be disliking it, but that's fine. That's on them. I'm not trying to trample over nobody's culture or religion. I'm very respectful of that. This is an album art and I love Jimi Hendrix, right?
Right.
I go to sleep. I wake up.
I share a birthday with Jimi Hendrix, by the way.
Say that again.
I share a birthday with Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, nice. But say, I wake up and there is some right-wing page on Twitter that's popularized that image as comedians making fun of Hindu gods again. And everybody from PM office to Aditya Thackeray to any minister, any police officer somewhere is tagged underneath. And I was like, thank God I'm in New York. Thank the Lord I'm in New York, right? And it's a strange place to be. Because you're like, who are these people and why do they have so much time for me? I'm not that important. Please, right? You're saying?
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just like, it's just very amusing to me that sort of a herd behavior carries itself that way.
Yeah. No, so exactly. The I forgot to mention it. The darker side of it, obviously, is that it's now much more targeted against my mother. Mm. And she obviously does have to live there wants to live there. And also, like, you know, they can't, like, there is a difference of values. Like, they are astonished that she would have had, like, a love affair with a Pakistani, that she would have had a child, that, like, she maybe grew up in a place where none of those things mattered in any serious way. Like, it was absolutely fine to do that. And even things like, you know, like illegitimacy, like, it's a big thing for them. They're like, oh my god, you're like a bastard, you're illegitimate. But like I have half a dozen friends who have like children sometimes after they get before they get married. Sometimes they hold off the wedding just so they could have kids and then they get married later. So like, these are actually, there is a conflict of values here, you know, like we do not share the same worldview. And so part of it is like a kind of joking, like, oh, whatever, you know, you're public enemy number one. Part of it is the coming into being of a certain moral system. And of course, like, I would have to add to this that I'm also like gay and married to a man. And like, you know, all of it adds up to the fact that, like, you're like, you know, you can't really live here. Like, right. You have to find somewhere where you can live and where you don't have to, like, fight these battles that don't need to be fought, you know? And so there's a deeper cultural side to it.
Who are you voting for now that you're voting? Who are you going to vote for in the upcoming election? If I may.
Well, considering that I've been, like, atoning for having supported Modi in 2014, whether I like it or not, whether there are policies of his I agree with or not, I'm 100% voting for the other side this time. It's the first time I'm voting, by the way.
No, you're going to be voting in America, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be voting in America.
So you're going to be voting Biden? You can't say that. No, I mean, that's always a trick question, right?
Like, it's my first vote, you know. Like, let me have the whatever privacy. They call it, the secret franchise. Yeah.
Right. No, I give it to you. It's I mean, I was so invested in American politics too while I was there, and it's such a circus of its own nature. Like, I don't think Indians realize the complexity of it, because when I come back, they ask me very simplistic questions, and I understand because I was asking those questions not too long ago myself, but. Oh my God. It's so amusing to me how that plays out. What are your further plans? When do we expect the next book? What are you working on? Are you working on something?
Yeah, I'm working on fiction at the moment, on a novel. And it's been through this whole COVID period. So I hope I'm not, like, too foggy headed to know whether it's good or bad or whatever. But, like, I'm going to keep working on that, and that'll be the next thing. And I'm doing a lot of journalism. I've just become a contributing writer for the Times, for the style section of the New York Times, which includes travel and lots of, like, interesting projects. So I'll be doing a lot more long form writing.
Nice.
And it's also, like, sends me to places other than India, so I can kind of, like, let that part of things cool down for
let the breakup settle.
A decade, two decades. You know?
Right.
Whatever it takes.
Uh-huh. And where are you looking forward to going? Like, what is the kind of places that you like to go to when you're traveling?
I'm going for an assignment. As much as one can say that one is, but I'm going to Turkey for quite an interesting assignment, which is, like, using what was basically the beginning of Stranger to History, and in some ways, like, revisiting that, but revisiting a younger self as well, and like writing in that idea of, like, using travel as a way to, like, go back to somebody who you were 10 or 15 years ago, you know, and that's one place that I'm interested in. I'm very, very keen to travel to South America, especially, I mean, to Central America, to Mexico. I would, you know, like, as you said, with America here, I mean, that there are these layers of, like, stuff that, like, are very similar to India, of historical, like, difficulties of race, of old religion reborn in modern religion or in Christianity. And so I'm learning Spanish, and I would love to, in some ways, come around some years later to, like, repay the favor that Octavio Paz did by coming to India, by writing in some meaningful way, because I feel it's the real privilege of being Indian, is which I wish that we could realize. People like Tagore very much realize that, which is that you are an Asian culture with a very natural one arm sticking out all the way to Japan because of Hindu Buddhist culture and because of the spread of Sanskritic culture, but you also do have this other history which you could allows you to reach as far as Turkey and Morocco. You've had the British, so you're naturally connected in certain ways to Europe. Like, the whole world is yours. You don't need to get rid of any of it. You know, the Indian has the possibility to be, like, the most cosmopolitan man on the planet or woman on the planet, because we know all these things, and we need to find ways, I feel like, because our history is so interesting and so complex, to be observers elsewhere, to write in, like, you know, because I think that it's a very distinctive way of looking
I think part of the privilege also of being Indian is the automatic sense of safety in difference. And I think it's like,
right.
I never felt strange being around Jewish people or, you know, Christians or like anybody. You may use whatever identity marker for that. It was just never strange because I have seen the same, say, right. cultural yeah. festival being done in 8 different ways since I was a kid with 8 different things. And it's all fine. Right, yeah. Like this, the whole Chalta Hai idea is a very libertarian idea. And if you extend it to the cosmopolitan domain, you're like, you know what, that's a pretty damn good privilege. And that's part of the fear that I share, I think, is that that's going to get reduced. You know, when you said about how...
Well, this is it. One, yeah.
Go ahead, please.
No, go on.
I was saying, when you were talking about, I think you were mentioning a certain book about, or a certain manuscript about sexuality or something like that. And well, the transgressions were built into the mainstream. Like the transgressions are part of the main node of literature. I don't know if you remember, but Abhijit made that point in a video on his Twitter, Abhijit Iyer Mitra, where he was at Konark Temple and he's like, this is not a temple. Yeah. He made that very
humble.
Yeah. And he got in trouble for that.
I know.
Right?
I know. But so that's very important, like that feeling of being so complex and of being so sensitive that like nobody can say anything and you just want to stand there like clutching your culture because you're so afraid that something's going to hurt it or someone's going to, like, that is not the spirit of like Indian cosmopolitanism. That was not the spirit of Gandhi or Nehru or Tagore or Siddhartha. There was a great like a sense of confidence and of a creative engagement with the rest of the world. And so it suddenly become this like shrunken, fearful people.
Right.
Like that's really like a, you know, then you end up kind of in some sort of, you'll need a theocracy to protect you from like, you know, the world, because it's the world is so frightening. So anyone could say anything. Anyone could, you know,
right.
like upset you or like, so you need like whatever happens at the end of this, it's very important that like, that you make people make their peace with that situation, because, you know, it does have incredible destructive potential.
When I try to talk to you about the civilizational state sort of becoming adjusting towards an ideological state, that the theocracy is the worst of my nightmares when it comes to that.
Right.
I often end up wondering, is like, are you guys awake to the fact that the same road that we're taking right now can end up brilliantly, beautifully a social renaissance the way you ideally imagine it to be, or it might end up into an Iran? And I'm no, absolutely not. Right. And you were right. It's after the whole controversy had gone down on my Twitter about, you know, me abusing whatever Hindu gods, I was like, please don't carry your cultures in such a fragile manner. I'm not looking to offend it.
Yeah.
Be more courageous.
Yeah. And also like what do they want? Like if you ask them, like, what is the India that they imagine? Like, is it a place where there are, for instance, like you have IITs, you have maybe institutes of classical studies, you have a prominent place for Indian learning in your education. Is that the kind of thing you want? But you want like modern highways, lots of travel, bars and restaurants, boys and girls going to, do you want all of that? Or is that, because I don't know what this other vision is.
I don't think that they
haven't really articulated it.
You're right. And that's because we've gotten into this age of anti-intellectualism where, you know, people who were the forebearers of, you know, pushing human experience, writers, artists in general, intellectuals, are looked down upon in a way. And it sort of scares me that is the mood. You're absolutely right. At the point where you ask a certain someone of a certain nature as to what do you imagine the future of India to be, and they go back to the Sone Ki Chidiya dream, it is a recursion to history. It's this nostalgic romanticism that I will not make peace with. Like you said in the beginning,
what
right?
does it look like every day, the Sone Ki Chidiya? Like
exactly.
What is it actually going to look and feel like, you know?
You're right. It has to be put down in words for you to then conceptualize it in your mind properly, for you to then act towards it. You cannot have, right, you're absolutely right. And I mean, it is, well, it's all sorts of things. I mean, I often say that there is no point of political argumentation if the economy is not in a safe place. We live in a materialistic world driven by capitalistic motivations. Let's not talk about all abstractions until we figure out the economy. And so, you know.
Well, this was my great, like, this is why, like, this was my great, the great appeal for Modi for me in 2014 was, I was like, I don't care about chauvinism and Hindutva if there's prosperity. Mm. If there's prosperity, like, people are too invested. And then a bad idea can't really take hold. Let them have, they want to have like a Ram temple. They want to have like this stuff on their cars. They want to say Bharat Mata Ki Jai five times a day. Let them say all that, but let them have jobs and like be part of like a future that looks something like, let's use just South Korea as a model, you know, where you're moving in that direction and you're moving at that pace. You know, even a tyranny like China, it's moved enough people. Enough people have come onto the side where they earn $10,000 a year. And then a society becomes very stable. Mm. It becomes very hard for a truly catastrophic idea to take hold. You know, and that's not to say like people like places like Iran were very rich when they committed suicide. Places like Russia were on the absolute up. They were like one of at the forefront of Western civilization when they decided to lose an entire century from which they never recovered. So these moments of change are very volatile. And the fear for me was always like, if there isn't prosperity, enough prosperity to feed this transition, then a vacuum is left where a truly bad idea can take hold. And now what I fear is that that bad idea is being fostered. You know, it's all this cultural stuff. It's all like some kind of like vaguer and vaguer dream of some Ram Raj or Hindu like power. And it's like, if you lose a generation if one doesn't change code. That's the fear for me. Like 30 or 40 years at a time like this, or at a time of what used to be possibility, it's the difference between like either making it as a country or ending up as a basket case.
You're right. 30 years in our time are not 30 years 100 years ago. By that standard, they're 300 years. And in every sense of the word, like, you know, I sometimes Twitter surprises me with something nice. And there was a tweet that said, there's quantum computing, Neuralink, CRISPR, flying to Mars and all of that happening on one end. And the world's media is focused on this buffoonery that happens in global politics all around the world in a similar fashion, in a similar pattern, over and over, over and over. And it's like, can we please be invested in something like that? Can we please? I don't, for me, even the opposite is true, right? I'm fine with the fact. You're right. Most political decisions flower in retrospect, right? So even if it's all Hindutva and all of that, eventually if everybody has the money, they look back, be like, great decision. That was the best we could have done. But if that doesn't happen, right, the odds are you'd hate this moment in history. This, right? And even the opposite true. If you leave out all cultural significance and if you give people economic prosperity, I'm fine with even that. When the nightmare of an entire society, civilization, is starving to death under a flyover and looks at you with eyes half dead, right? It is very hard to go to sleep peacefully. It just genuinely is very hard to go to sleep peacefully. And so those are more immediate problems to me. And then everything else can follow, right? You were saying?
Go on. No, I was just going to say that, you know, there are so many people who would have been like literally at that very, very vulnerable point. And now with the kind of like economic bad news that we're seeing, that moment when regardless of their politics, regardless of any things, that they would have been able to make decisions in the lives of their children that would have like advanced some sort of like deeper base in like knowledge and education and in elevating to a new level of society. Like all of those things, all of those decisions, man, put to the scale of like in hundreds of thousands, people would suddenly not be able to make any of those choices. You know, they would suddenly, be reduced. They would be making a journey back to where they came from economically. And so that's like, it's an absolutely shattering. I guess what I'm trying to get at is the emotional cost when people are full of dreams and possibilities and when they have to put those aside for the foreseeable future. You know, it's absolutely, we describe it as, 23.9% reduction or whatever, but we're really dealing with human beings. You know, we're dealing with like the destiny of tens of millions of human beings who won't be going anywhere.
Right. You're absolutely right. I mean, I've had conversations with people who set out on dreams 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years ago, who were genuinely sitting down and wondering if they were wrong all along. And it's the default state of human thinking that, you know, you first come to yourself and ask if the problem's with you, maybe it is that, maybe, but it's the wrong place to be asking questions. I tell my friend, it's like, you know, you did what you could. This is not in your hands. And I mean, I'm not saying that it's in anybody's hand, but we are in a dire situation. And that's just the reality of it. And the sooner we accept it, the sooner we make peace with the fact that there is a future and a past that, you know, fall in order in a certain way. But Atish, thank you so much for doing this. This has been absolutely...
Thank you. It was great to speak to you.
Did I stress you out a little? Because you just seemed to like relax a little as soon as I said bye.
No. I've been very relaxed. I'm just like, I slept quite little last night. So I've been a bit foggy headed. But I'm very relaxed.
All right.
And it was wonderful to talk to you, and look me up if you're ever here.